The topic tonight is loving the part of us we've hated. Hate may seem like a strong word, but I guess I'm speaking from personal experience. So we'll start right out with a quote from the Buddha, because I think that's, you know, a good starting point on a Dharma talk. He said, "You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection." How about that? So the way I'm kind of structuring this tonight is I want to start out by talking about how human beings, how we sort of create a sense of personal identity and personality, ego, and then what some of us do as we strive to evolve and transform in our lives, which is probably, you know, probably applies to pretty much everybody in the room here. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be here. You could be home watching, I don't know, what's on TV? Cat videos on the internet. And we'll talk about some of the things that we discover along the way, the different concepts we create in our mind, different challenges we face, pitfalls. We'll talk about stuff like healthy individuation and spiritual bypassing. And we'll explore how our sense of self is really an illusion. It really is. And we'll talk about what the Buddha said about that, and about no self. And we'll explore what to do about that. So that's, you guys game for that? We'll see how it goes. But you know, what happens is in life, we tend to establish ideas about what we should think and how we should feel and how we should act. And we learn to identify with certain aspects of ourselves as we do that. We view ourselves through what are actually temporary emotional states, but we think of them as being permanent. We identify as maybe being soft-hearted or generous, disciplined, intelligent, kind, honest, loyal, trustworthy, courteous, reverent. Is this starting to sound like Boy Scouts? Yeah. Or maybe we identify as angry, insecure, arrogant, cynical, greedy, impulsive, obsessive, sarcastic, timid, soft-spoken, stubborn. Do any of us view ourselves this way? Any of this? Has anyone else described us this way? And then we bought that and said, yeah, that's me. Well, what happens is we often do this. We buy into this, and then we reinforce this by continuing to play out these roles. Or these characteristics. And then we take on roles like I'm a father, I'm a brother, I'm a son, I'm a boyfriend, I'm a substance abuse counselor, I'm a meditation teacher, I'm an American, I'm a North Carolinian, I'm an Asheville-ian. Is that what they say? Asheville-ian? I happen to be an addict in long-term recovery. I'm a group facilitator. So sometimes I refer to myself as a Buddhist or a vegan. I'm a registered independent, see? So see, these are all these roles, and what this does is it creates this very fixed sense of I, me. So as we do this, we really create this. And it starts from the beginning. And right as we grow up, we start to develop our personality. And a lot of it is stuff that we buy into, that we're told. You know, we pick up a stuff from our family, from our parents, perhaps from church, the people we hang out with, media. You know, we get ideas from advertising about who we are and what we're supposed to be. And think of other people. Think of friends, family, other people here perhaps that you know. What kind of traits or characteristics do you perceive in them? Or public figures. Think about people like President Obama or Oprah, Keith Richards, Ram Dass, David Letterman, Donald Trump. Are you getting certain images, certain characteristics, traits, roles, these kinds of things? So this becomes very fixed, and we believe this is how things are. So in terms of ourself, a lot of times when we look at the certain traits that we have or characteristics, particularly the negative ones, we say, well, you know, I really want to aspire to change. You know, there's the good ones, the positive ones, and there are the negative ones. And do you have any aspects of or characteristics that you've really learned to dislike, that you've wanted to change? You know, what's your attitude towards those? Many decades ago, there was an expression that went around a lot, and this was during the times of the self-help movement and pop psychology and everything, and they said, we're all whole, perfect, and complete, just the way we are. Anybody remember that? That was like the mantra, and we go around and keep repeating it. We're whole, perfect, and complete, just the way we are. It was like a big self-esteem thing, right? Well, there's a Zen teacher out in San Francisco at that time, there was, named Shinryo Suzuki Roshi. And he was quoted as telling his students, he said, we're all whole, perfect, and complete, and some of us could use a little work. So maybe he was a little tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, what did he really mean? We could all use a little work. Well, most of us think we could use a little work. So, you know, what do? We come, we meditate, we study the Dharma, we do retreats. And why do we do this? Because we respond to an inner call to transform and to awaken. This may come from some kind of vision that we have of inner of innate wholeness. It might come from having what psychologist Abraham Maslow called a peak experience. We may have some kind of peak experience and say, yes, that's what I want. It could be an experience of really tasting what it's like to be completely connected with everyone and everything. And it's like, yes, I can be like that. Or it might come from deep experiences of suffering. All of us have acted in ways we've later regretted. And there perhaps have been some pretty serious consequences from what we've done. And many times we've blamed ourselves and vowed to change. So what happens when we do this? We set out on our own personal version of what Joseph Campbell called the hero's journey. Perhaps you're familiar with Joseph Campbell, the great teacher. And he said in The Hero of a Thousand Faces, he described the narrative of this journey as a hero ventures forth from the world of common day into region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are encountered and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man. Boons. So, you know, this, you know, life is filled with all these stories about the hero's journey. You know, the Buddha, you know, here he left this life of luxury and he went out as a mendicant and you know, going from luxury to this life of being, you know, an ascetic and all these strict practices. And then he sits under the tree and achieves nibbana, the hero's journey. And didn't Jesus go out in the desert and fast for 40 days, as the story goes? And it goes on and on and on, you know, all these great stories. And so, you know, this is the journey that we're going on. You know, we may not go in the desert for 40 days. We may not sit under the Bodhi tree for days on end, but this is what we do. And sometimes we meet a lot of challenges. And sometimes our journey takes us into the dark night of the soul. You know, it's a term that was coined by the saint John of the Cross as this spiritual crisis that we encounter in this journey. You know, in our search for truth and for healing, we may descend into some really deep areas of darkness, into these places of unknown. The ground is pulled, the ground is shaking, our life is shattered. The rug's been pulled out from under us in this process. Back in 1991, I went to Asia for a couple of months, and it was a spiritual pilgrimage. And I studied with these teachers, these Tibetan Buddhist teachers, and I went into holy sites and into places with very powerful energy and received teachings. And I was in Calcutta, and I ended up meeting Mother Teresa and talking with her, which, you know, I left. I remember walking out of Mother House, and my feet weren't even touching the ground. And I couldn't even talk about it for months because it had such an impact on me. And then I came back to the United States, and nothing made sense. It's like I was tipped upside down. And it took me a long time to start understanding that I could get through this and that there was meaning in life. And it was very simple. I went in to a checkout. I went into a store, and I was in the checkout line, and a woman was having a difficult time, and I just looked at her, and I said, "Are you going to be okay? Are you okay?" And just that simple act of kindness and how she responded told me, yes, I found my meaning again, just a simple act of kindness. But this spiritual journey I had been had really taken me into the dark night. It had turned my life upside down. Sometimes the dark night of the soul has been referred to as a spiritual emergency. That's a term that came out of the pioneering work of a Czech psychiatrist named Stan Grof. And it's a form of identity crisis. We experience all these drastic changes to our whole system of meaning. Our purposes, goals, values, attitudes, beliefs are all shaken. So this is what happens when we sign on for this sometimes. And the thing is, conventional psychiatry, they label this as pathology. If you talk to some people about these experiences, they want to lock you up. Yeah. So when we go on the process of this process of discovery, sometimes we bump up against our shadow, a term, you know, that was coined by Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung. And he says that basically there's this whole side of us that's of our nature that's been cast into the unconscious and held there as unhealthy, unacceptable, maybe even demonic. We want to repress it. It's like the beast in the labyrinth, the dragon that has to be slain, the demon in the wilderness. And he says, to be human is to have that shadow. And he said, though, that the shadow contains energies and forces which, when harnessed through practice, can give rise to realizations. So should we be scared of the shadow? Or should we embrace it? So, we grow up in a world that tells us what's acceptable and unacceptable. Most of us grew up in a predominantly Judeo-Christian culture that dictates our attitudes. So, you know, this is the conflict that goes on. And then, as we take the spiritual journey, sometimes we create these idealized notions of what it means to be spiritual. How are we supposed to act? We're supposed to follow certain ideals of perfection and goodness and wholesomeness. And it can be really painful when we establish some kind of spiritual identity and then feel like we're a fraud when we can't measure up. I remember, you know, getting certain ideas about what it meant to be a Buddhist. You know, I actually thought that I shouldn't watch football anymore. Because it's a violent sport. It's violence. That's what it is. I can't watch football if I'm a Buddhist. You know? Oh, I should be a vegetarian now. Oh, I can't drive an SUV. You know, it's got to be, you know, some small car. Should I have a picture of the Dalai Lama on the wall? You know, this is the stuff that happens a lot of times. And then all these cultural trappings that come along with certain traditions. It's not, doesn't show up in this tradition much, but if you get into Tibetan practice in Japanese Zen, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that comes with this, you know? All the Tibetan and Japanese culture and everything. And am I supposed to change my name now? And all this kind of stuff, you know, it can get a little weird. And we create this idealized persona, you know, and it kind of becomes like this spiritual straitjacket, like, you know, how am I supposed to act? And then when we don't measure up, it can be really hard. Buddhism has really been evolving over about 2,500 years, and primarily in Eastern cultures, really until about the last 150 years or so. But the traditions, as they existed, didn't really address Western culture very well. And practice in a traditional way, Buddhism really doesn't have an inherent component to address the a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about. A lot of these emotional disturbances, a lot of the issues that we bump up against. You know, the type and extent of alienation that's very common in our culture doesn't exist over there. Maybe you've heard the story about the Dalai Lama. He was like in this symposium with all these psychologists and psychiatrists and everything, and somebody talked about self-hate, and he turned to his translator, and he's having a conversation like, can you explain this to me? And this went on and on. He's asking, he didn't get it. Self-hatred was as alien to him as it would be to try to talk about igloos and snowballs to somebody that lived in Tahiti. It just couldn't compute. Jack Kornfield writes, in A Path with Heart, in an unfortunate way, many students of Eastern and Western spirituality have been led to believe that if they experience difficulty, it's simply because they haven't practiced long enough or hard enough, or somehow haven't been practicing according to the teachings. This is why Insight Meditation Society has a resident psychotherapist. If we follow the teachings in their original pure form, sometimes they don't address these things. I lived at a Tibetan Buddhist center for a year, and they followed the teachings very strictly the way they were presented by the Tibetan teacher who set it up, even though he was no longer living. And I went through a lot of challenges there. And I went back into the dark night where things got upside down. And I started beating myself up because I was going down and down, and I was practicing hard, and I couldn't seem to pull it together. And I went to the teacher, who was a Western teacher, but was really following the strict traditional mold. And I told her, I said, I'm really depressed. And then I started talking to her about how I felt that some old trauma had been triggered. And she looked at me and she said, Eddie, we have to be careful about developing concepts around these things. She was telling me basically to use it as practice and don't process it. I needed to process it, and I kept going down. She was very well intentioned, but she didn't understand what Jack Kornfield was talking about. I needed to go see a psychotherapist. And there's a whole long story that goes with that we don't have time, where that ended up taking me. The short version of the story is it was a treatment center, rehab. So, you know, she's talking about being careful of strengthening concepts. I had to work through my own mental and emotional turmoil. And I wasn't able to do it just in the meditation practice. I needed to get help. And then we have something called spiritual bypassing. It's using meditation practices as a way of avoiding feelings rather than transforming them. Spiritual bypassing is just basically using the practice as a means of avoidance. You know, rather than using alcohol and drugs and gambling and sex and porn and media and work and all these other means to avoid what we're feeling, we just get lost in meditation. There was a long time where I thought the purpose of meditation was to feel good. And I would do meditation and I would get into some really nice states of concentration and I felt great. It was like getting high. And then I just ignored what was going on. And some of you may have heard about the jhanas, which is a practice of it's meditative absorptions, where you can go into really deep states of concentration. And it really takes you into altered states of consciousness. And it feels really good. But if you listen to a jhana teacher, they will tell you that it's a bridge. It's to be used to develop deep states of concentration in order to do wisdom and insight practices. But a person can get stuck there and use it as a spiritual bypass and just say, I'm going to hang out here. This feels real good. So these are the traps and the pitfalls that we can run into along the way. So rather than being present and open to what we're experiencing and working with it, we're just splitting off and disconnecting. Spiritual practice is not just about feeling good. It's not about collecting the cash and prizes along the way, you know? It's about being in the present moment and learning to be okay with what's happening. Healing only really takes place when we return and embrace our wounds and accept them and appreciate what they've given us. Self-compassion is not idealistic. It's our capacity to genuinely accept ourselves with our shadow, live with our illusions. That's why Thich Nhat Hanh says, he talks about working with anger. You know, anger, that's one of those negative emotions, right? He says, welcome it. Let it come in like an old friend and hang out. He says, when you get angry, take care of your anger. Look deeply into it. In other words, mindfulness practice. The Buddha taught about anatta, which is defined as no self, or the teaching that any notion of a permanent, autonomous self is really an illusion. There's no permanent, eternal, unchanging self that exists in our bodies, in our lives. In his classic book, What the Buddha Taught, the Theravadan scholar Walpola Rahula said, according to the teachings of the Buddha, the idea of a self is an imaginary false belief that has no corresponding reality. And it produces harmful thoughts of me and mine, selfish desire, craving, attachment, hatred, ill will, conceit, pride, egoism, and other defilements, impurities, and problems. So getting stuck in this notion that we have this sense of self is very problematic. But it doesn't fit our ordinary experience. We say, well, wait a minute, am I not here? Who's sitting here right now? And actually the Buddha, he encouraged his disciples not to think about it too much. He says, just do the practice. In fact, there was a guy named Dogen who was a 13th century Zen master. He wrote in his book, he said, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. Gee, thanks for clearing that up. Let's not just dwell on it too much, like, you know, but so both Buddhist and Western psychologies stress the need for a healthy development of self. In fact, to not develop a healthy sense of health is basically considered a crisis. So nor ordinarily, it just sort of evolves naturally. We develop a fundamental need to be able to manage life, to cope with family and work and relationships and care for self and others. It gives us a ground to stand on. to generate confidence and composure and adaptability and set boundaries to survive. In Buddhism, this is called the relative I. Relative I. So we have sheer reality, you know, which is there is no fixed self, but there's a relative I. We do walk through life in, you know, I am sitting here. So it's important to distinguish between our normal, stable, functional ego or sense of self, rational or relative I, and this emotionally charged sense of ego, which keeps us grasping and clinging and creating suffering for ourselves. But it's only through really looking deeply into it that the picture starts to become clear. So we work with it. And how do we work with it? Well, one thing we do is we watch our mind in meditation. We watch our thoughts arise and pass away. We experience bodily sensations arise and pass. And some are very pleasant, you know, and we enjoy them. And some not so much. Pleasant. But none of them are permanent. None of them are solid. They're all empty of inherent existence. And so are we. You know, whether we're angry or sad or, you know, whatever is going on, it's all empty. It's all tentative, fictitious. We create it in our minds. We have all kinds of stories we create. And I want to give you a metaphor of how this happens. I lived in Phoenix in the 80s and 90s, and if you've been in Phoenix in the summer, you know that it's pretty hot, right? So the goal is to find a swimming pool or head for the mountains. And there was a spot in central Arizona called the Mogollon Rim, which was an escarpment. And at the top, it was around 8,000 feet, and at the bottom, it was around 5,000 feet. Well, 8,000 feet was a lot more comfortable in August than Phoenix at 1,100 feet. So I would go up there and do little retreats on the weekends. And I found this sweet little spot that would go up and hang out, and it was on a cliff, and I would just look out over this vast expanse. It was absolutely spectacular. Well, in the late afternoon, very often storms would come up in August. And one day I was sitting there and the sky was clear, and all of a sudden I noticed there were a few cumulus clouds, these puffy clouds. And all of a sudden I saw them start to gravitate towards each other. And it got a bigger cloud. And then there was this dark spot form. Now this is at eye level. You gotta remember, right? There's like 3,000 feet below this. So I'm looking at this, and there's this dark cloud forming and broadening and expanding, and the next thing you know is this ass-kicking thunderstorm. It is lightning and thundering, and I mean lightning shooting out of this, and it's black, and it's just crazy. Totally dark except for the lightning shooting out. And above the clouds, absolute sunshine. So it's clear sky, clouds, dark, and stormy. And I thought, this is what happens in my mind. It's like the sky is my basic pure nature. It's like Buddha mind, clear, luminous, no clouds. And then what happens? I hear this. Jack's looking at me and he's going, when's he going to stop doing that? Or maybe he's not. But it's possible, you know, that something happens and we create an aversion around it. And we want it to change. We don't want it to be the way it is. So it's a thought that arises. It's a sense experience. And perhaps, you know, there's some memory about it. With me, it's dogs barking. You know, when dogs keep barking and barking and barking, it's very agitating for me. And I create a story around it. Why doesn't that person, you know, why is that dog tied up? They're not supposed to be tied up. It's a city ordinance. You can't tie up dogs. And, you know, this is the dark cloud for me. And there's an emotional reaction. This is what happens. So instead of me having this clear sky, I have this storm. And I got to tell you, just watching that event unfold in front of me was amazing. I mean, it was unbelievable. What a spectacle. But then when I could attach this to it and realize that's what happens in my mind, it's a visual that I've been able to hold on to. But that's what we do. And you know, finally the storm dissipated and went away. Like it was never there. This is what we do. This is how we create this sense of I-ness. And I got all kinds of stories going on in my head, and they come up. And one of the big ones is Margaret and I are trying to get our website going right now. And fortunately, we have somebody helping us now, but we were trying to do it on our own. And it's like every message of I am so stupid around technology kept coming up. And this started in 1992 when I bought my first computer. I brought it home, took it out of the box, and I couldn't figure out how to turn it on. And I had to bribe a friend with a six-pack of Heineken to come over and get my computer turned on. And ever since then, I mean, I was the guy that I never programmed a VCR to record in my life. This is my story. Some of you have been here on Sunday mornings. I try to get this thing going, and as soon as it doesn't work, this is the cloud forming. It's the dark cloud. And next thing you know, it's thundering and it's lightning. And this is my demon. This is my dragon. So what do I get to do with it? I get to sit with it. I get to pause. See if I can get out of conditioned mind and not get hooked. There's an acronym called RAIN, R-A-I-N. Some of you have heard about it, perhaps some of you haven't. This is a very healthy practice to use to work with this. RAIN, R, recognize. A, allow or accept. I, investigate. N, non-identification. So we're just going to walk through this. And I teach meditation at a residential aftercare program for guys in early recovery. And this is something we talk about regularly because these are guys that are trying to get clean. One of the guys that was there a few months ago when I was out there has already relapsed and died. So this is serious business. These guys know what they're up against. So I talk to him and I say, this is something you can use so you can start learning different ways of dealing with being uncomfortable. Because the old days, when you got uncomfortable, what did you do? And how did that work out? How did it work out for David? David's the guy that died, OD'd. So recognition, hey, what's happening right now in my experience? It's bringing this gentle, kind awareness to the present moment. It's moving from darkness to light. It's shining a light on what's going on. In fact, the Buddha said, we can light a lamp in the darkness. And we can bow to the experience of whatever's arising.
All right, enough.
And we can say, so, this is how it is. A, allow or accept. This is where we say, okay, can I live with this? Yeah, it kind of sucks, but maybe I wished it wasn't happening at some level, but we can say it is what it is. There's a Zen saying, if you understand, things are as they are. If you don't understand, things are still as they are. So it's not just about being passive and unwilling to try to change a situation. It's just saying, can I accept it? Can I allow this to be here? I investigate, and I'm giving you the short version of this thing, okay, because I want to allow some time for discussion. Investigation is the I part. It's basically what Thich Nhat Hanh calls seeing deeply, really looking into what the experiences and how we're perceiving it, recognizing a situation and looking underneath and say, okay, what's happening now in my body? What does this feeling want from me? What am I believing about myself? Byron Katie has the four questions. She's not a Buddhist teacher, but at least she doesn't advertise herself that way, but it's spot on. She says, first question, is it true? Can you absolutely know that it's true? How do you react? What happens when you believe that thought? And who would you be without the thought? That's just another way of investigating. You know, what's really going on? It allows us to go deeper and to look into our feelings, look into our thoughts, look into our stories, developing insight. Yeah. Yeah. So this is really important, and to do it in a compassionate way. And the last one is non-identification. And this is stepping out of the center of this cloud and saying, this is not who I am. It's saying, instead of saying, I'm angry right now, just say, I am an angry person. Instead of saying, I'm an angry person, it's saying, I'm just feeling anger. Notice the subtle shift? It's understanding at a deeper level that things aren't static and fixed and solid. There's just conditioned mind. It's like a dream. It's loosening up. In summary, when we identify with our mind, with our body, our feelings, our beliefs, our roles, we create and reinforce this sense of self, and we do it over and over again. But in the Buddhist practice, we get to step back and examine what's really happening here. You know, there's a fine line between surrender, allowing, and struggling and fighting. And it's all about awareness. Mm-hmm.